Hello and welcome to Lewis Nidus Law and the Lewis Nidus podcast. I'm your host, Holly Sonnebend, and today we'll be talking to consultant solicitor Paul Mason. Paul qualified as a solicitor 39 years ago and has been a duty solicitor at police stations and magistrates' courts since the scheme's inception 35 years ago. As well as dealing with the work generated by this, Paul has engaged primarily in serious and complex cases, ranging from murder, rape, and serious drug offences to the most complex of fraud allegations. In addition to his criminal caseload, he also undertakes transport regulatory work before the traffic commissioners in respect of heavy goods vehicle and public service vehicle operator licences. After being a partner at criminal practices in East and West London, Paul has been a consultant at Lewis Nidus for the last 7 years. Following the formation of the Crown Prosecution Service, Paul prosecuted for them as an agent for more than 10 years at courts throughout the London area and has given media interviews on vigilante paedophile hunters to French television on several occasions. Paul is joining us today to discuss his work involving such paedophile hunters. Paul, welcome to the show.
Welcome, and greetings to you, Holly.
So, Paul, what is the offence?
Well, the offence that we're looking at is meeting a child after grooming. It has to be committed by any person who's over the age of 18, and they commit the offence if they communicate with any person by any means whatsoever. Ordinarily, in this case, we're talking the internet, and having engaged with them on at least one or more occasions, they then meet or arrange to meet that person, and in doing so intend to commit an offence of a sexual nature with them. The important thing is that the intended victim has either got to be under 16, or the person who's committing the offence does not reasonably believe that they are 16 or over.
Why has there been a raise in the number of allegations?
Well, the offence itself, by its very nature, has existed for a very long time, and it's only really been the internet that has really brought it to the fore. Before the internet existed, it would always generally be within a familial relationship or in a family group, where a prospective offender would start, befriend a young person, would ingratiate themselves with their family, become part of their wider social circle, and generally bring the subject round to illegal activity. But it was slow and it was insidious, and because of the need to build up this long relationship with them and perhaps with their families, it tended to be within the family group and was often brushed under the carpet. It wouldn't become well known. And of course, because we have the ease of access and particularly the anonymity of the internet, we are finding a lot of abusers now don't even have to leave home in order to engage with people. Of course, likewise, neither do the vigilantes, people who often have a background of having been the victims of abuse, or some know somebody within their family who's been the victim, and who takes it upon themselves to consider that the police are not doing enough, and so they set up vigilante groups to entice people with the professed aim to do the police job for them, to get them off the street and see what they're doing as a public good. And of course, one of the main differences between the internet approach to the old style of grooming is that it is nearly always evidenced by a great deal of digital information. Any number of social media, there is now a trail of evidence of engagement, conversations, because it's normally always done in text. And imagine with any vigilante, you couldn't do it on the phone. And so we are seeing not so much an increase in activity, but an increase in detection, because it's now easily proved. And that's why a lot of these cases tend on the facts to be dealt with as pleas of guilty. But it is really because of the internet that has made both the offending and the catching a much easier thing to do.
What difference does it make if a vigilante is involved?
The important thing to remember about this offence is that it's committed if you communicate with somebody who you think is under 16 and then in due course arrange to meet with them for a nefarious purpose. So in that sense, it's irrelevant if the victim turns out to be a vigilante. And whilst it can offer, and often does offer, quite a bit of mitigation if there isn't actually a child involved, as long as the vigilante involves the police at an early stage and they effect the arrest and they are provided with the evidence from the telephone and social media, then the chances are that any subsequent prosecution will be effective, because ultimately, as long as you believe that they were under the age of 16, being enticed or entrapped by a vigilante is not a defence, never has been. Entrapment is not a defence to a crime.
What is the police attitude to vigilantes?
Statistics for 2018 show that something like 400 people or more have been prosecuted for this offence of internet child grooming. And of those, I think about 250 or more involved cases where the evidence was garnered by paedophile hunting groups. Their objections really are twofold. First is that many police forces are deeply unhappy about the activities of these groups because a number of the techniques they use, particularly around the terms of the encounter, are dubious in legality, and there have been numerous examples of vigilantes facing prosecution for their behaviour to the alleged offender, and they are often, as a result, at risk of assault allegations and false imprisonment. And I suppose because they insist on videoing these for public uploading to YouTube and to their own sites, there is great provocation, I imagine, even if they're not necessarily aware of it, to spice up the encounter and to create conflict where none need exist, because that is attractive. And it is that sort of encounter that the police are unhappy about because the impact it has. And of course, the police have a duty of care to anyone whom they prosecute. And publishing videos like this completely wipes out that duty of care, particularly where we've seen incidents of alleged offenders committing suicide, because this is a type of offence that some people may have hidden from their families for many years, and it's highly embarrassing for them. And ultimately, if it is a vigilante's desire for these offenders to face justice, that is what the court process is for, and they will face justice that way. And so the police are unhappy that in purporting to perform a public service, they are in fact doing completely the opposite. They're completely ignoring the right and duty of care that they owe to the people that they're confronting. And even though they are purporting to be working in the interests of children, they have no concern whatsoever about the effect this may have on an offender's own children and the effect it has on the wider family group, of course, who are not there by their very nature to be published. Now, of course, one can't ignore the fact that offences like this are capable of having a huge emotional effect on society. Nobody wants child sex offenders to exist, and they would like them all brought to justice. But the fact is, the police are much happier if a vigilante has to do this, that they bring it to their attention before any form of engagement and let them take it over, because the danger of having this encounter is that it allows the opportunity for important evidence, particularly, as I said, on telephones, frequently on computers, to be destroyed before the police can get hold of it. That is the evidence upon which, of course, the whole case is brought. It means, although it doesn't often happen, the individual concerned can run away. And then, of course, the police have to exhaust enormous resources trying to catch these people, whereas if they'd done it properly and engaged with the police at the outset, it would have stopped a great deal of resources being wasted simply because of the way in which the vigilantes are acting. So I agree, they can perform a service, but they are not trained. They're not obliged to follow the strict guidance which is given to police in these situations when they engage, if you like, in an entrapment environment. And so that is why the police are really troubled by them, and that's why a lot of vigilantes are served with cease and desist letters to stop them from doing it, because it just causes all sorts of problems for the police.
What other risks do vigilantes run in undermining their own cases?
Well, this is, I suppose, the second limb of the police concern, which is the question of entrapment. At the beginning of this podcast, I mentioned the fact that the mere fact that a vigilante has tempted somebody to engage in this doesn't mean that an offence is not committed. But without the training that the police have, there are dangers of overstepping the mark. The basic rule is it is not a defence to become entrapped to commit an offence. And the basic rule of law is that provided the person doing the enticing does nothing more than present an unexceptional opportunity to commit crime, then there's nothing wrong. That doesn't, if you like, act as an affront to ordinary people's perception of fairness. Another way of looking at it, of course, is I am perfectly entitled to open the door to temptation to you, but I must allow you to walk through that door entirely voluntarily. If I entice you, encourage you, threaten you, or just grab you by the scruff of the neck and push you through it, you run the risk of, has this person committed an offence of their own volition, an unexceptional opportunity to commit crime, or have they done something that they would not otherwise have done, except for the act of the person who's providing the entrapment, in this case, the vigilante. And of all the cases I've dealt with involving vigilantes, I've not yet had one either prosecuted or, if prosecuted, ever convicted, because of the fact that the vigilante is not trained, not bound by this law, to prevent a fair trial by reason of their behaviour. One example, I got the clue very early on when the evidence was served that, without wishing to generalise, all offenders or alleged offenders will have what I call a digital footprint. There will be evidence of prior membership of various internet groups, chat rooms. They will be active. And in this one case, there was no evidence at all. At the very early stage of the conversation with this vigilante, his comments were, I'm a 73-year-old man with polio. Why are you interested in me? And of course, by digging around, we found that the vigilante had been the person to instigate contact with this individual, which is unusual, because normally you expect it the other way around. Cut a long story short, the vigilante group had been informed this person was a paedophile without any evidence whatsoever, and never bothered to check the veracity of it. It turned out that my client was a well-known journalist who was about to publish a very damning and revealing book about a visiting politician from another country who was about to visit this country. And this came in just about a week beforehand, which meant the book wasn't published. And inquiries revealed that a number of other critics of this particular politician had suffered similar fates to take them out of the way. And of course, they've simply just opened the door to the vigilante, who made no checks at all and just ploughed on. And it became quite apparent that the ingredients, the offence, were not made out. And in one case, in fact, the police notified me today they were not going to proceed with it. This was a client who, one has to accept, did behave in a somewhat reprehensible manner in what he was asking what he thought was a young girl what to do. So of course he hasn't covered himself in glory, but the engagement took place over several days, and my client appeared to be getting cold feet, didn't want to meet, which of course isn't serving the needs of the vigilante, who wanted to get this encounter on video. And so they arranged for this apparent girl to contact him, to say she's in the area, she would like to meet him. He said he didn't want to, and he would be happy to pay for her fare to go home. And she said, well, I don't have any money. So he said, well, get him to take you to the station so you can go home to your grandmother, and get him to come around here and I'll pay the fare. Of course, that didn't serve their purpose. They said, well, the cab driver isn't going to allow me out of the car. So he then said, well, get the cab driver to bring you here. I will pay you the fare, and then he can take you to the station. So, of course, he comes out when told they've arrived, and then entrap him, and they call the police and have the video. When they provided the evidence of the conversations on WhatsApp and on text, they conveniently left out all of those texts that led to him being there. And of course, the important thing is the meeting has to be arranged by the alleged offender with the intention to commit a sexual offence. And so they got him there under false pretences. He hadn't committed the offence because he hadn't arranged a meeting with the sexual purpose in mind. It was quite clear what his reasons were. And he ended up on bail for 6 months while they were investigating this. They had to investigate the video. It was a vigilante group in Manchester doing this. And it became clear that this was a classic example that the rule of law had not been obeyed by this vigilante group, who were far more focused on getting a video of an encounter. And they completely undermined the prosecution case, undermined their own case by just simply allowing themselves to get carried away. And when the person doesn't bite, they have to walk away. But they didn't. They enticed him there. And therefore, whether you approve of my client's behaviour or not, nobody really could. The fact is, my job is to make sure that if he's going to be convicted, it's because the evidence against him meets the law and is proved beyond reasonable doubt. And if those are not, those ingredients are not there, and he hasn't committed the offence in the eyes of the law, then he should not be convicted. And trouble for vigilantes, when they don't have this training, whatever their motives, which may be perfectly morally understandable and acceptable, they have to follow the rule of law, because they cannot expect justice to be done if they are prepared to deny the same elements of justice to the person they're seeking to entrap. And that's often why the police are troubled, because the second limb is they are tainting the evidence they are given. The police have to prosecute to show that the person committing the allegation is engaging with somebody who they do not believe to be over 16, and that they are intending to meet them for a sexual activity. And the actions of these vigilantes when things don't go their way is completely undermining what these offences were intended to do.
Where can people contact you with potential inquiries?
My details are on the Lewis Nides website, but if anyone wishes to make inquiries with me, the best way to contact me will be at my email address, which is pmason@lewisnides.co.uk.
Fantastic. That's all from the Lewis Nides podcast today. You can find us at Lewis Nides Law on Twitter and at lewisnides.co.uk. Thank you for listening.